We're going to get a perspective on the debt and deficit debate from a member of the House Republican Caucus now, Congressman Bill Huizinga of Michigan, joins us from his office on Capitol Hill. Welcome back, Congressman. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you again, Scott.
You told the Muskegon, Michigan Lakeshore Chamber of Commerce that it's critical for the debt ceiling to be raised, but that doesn't mean that you'd vote for it. Explain that reasoning to us, if you could, please.
I think it's pretty universally understood that having us go into default is not what should happen. None of us want that. None of us are pursuing that. We're pursuing real change. We're pursuing real solutions. I'm just frustrated because I'm not convinced yet. I haven't seen it yet out of the administration or out of the Senate that we've got a plan. Now, I think that's changing with the House Republicans coming forward with plans. And so I think we can do that. But I want to make sure that this, whatever the solution is something that fundamentally changes the trajectory of our spending as a country and changes the bad habits that got us into where we are.
So when the president calls for a large-scale package to cut the deficit by $4 trillion over 10 years, is that a framework you can work with?
Well, quite honestly, I don't believe that that's large-scale. When you break down the $4 trillion, a trillion of that's in interest savings, a trillion of that is in tax increases. So it's really $2 trillion that he's been talking about in actual cuts. And when you look at the amount of overspending that we're doing, that it really isn't going to cut it.
What would be enough?
If there were some other things linked up with that, if we're talking purely numbers, that doesn't get there. If we are talking about putting in some sort of caps within the percentage of the GDP that we will spend in government, if we're talking about a balanced budget amendment, that's something I ran on, I think would be very important. It's something that in the state of Michigan, where I served in the legislature, we have a constitutional requirement to balance the budget every year. It forces a different conversation. If you are making a conscious decision to spend something that you don't have, you either have one or two ways to address that. Either raise taxes to get the money to spend that, or you don't spend it.
The debt ceiling was raised, we have all learned in recent weeks, 17 times under President Reagan, 4 times under President Clinton, and 7 times under President George W. Bush. Why is this time different?
Well, I was actually working for my predecessor, Pete Hoekstra, for 6 of those years, from 1997 through until 2003. And everybody sort of has this recollection that it was all peaches and cream and no questions were asked and, oh, sure, let's just raise the debt ceiling. And I remember it very differently. I remember people being very upset and not understanding why we were going into this kind of debt. And have no doubt, whether it was Republican administrations or Democrat administrations, we've been overspending for too long. Now, in the last couple of years, it has been absolutely kicked into overdrive, and I think it has just forced its way to the front and has a prominence now that that it never had before.
Congressman, unlike some other House freshmen, you know the terrain pretty well. When people talk about the good old days when the parties got along and didn't draw lines in the sand, are we romancing those days?
I think we are, and it's ironic that you bring it up. I had a group out on the Speaker's balcony, which is the backside of the Capitol that overlooks where the president gets inaugurated. And you look down Pennsylvania Avenue, and what's blocking the way to see the White House? It's the Department of Treasury. And why? Andrew Jackson was mad at Congress at the time and had the architect and the builders move the building so he could block the view from the White House of the Capitol because he didn't want to see the detestable Congress. So, you know, when we talk about how it was all kumbaya and roasting marshmallows around the fire, it isn't exactly accurate.
Congressman Bill Huizinga of Michigan, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks again, Scott.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time for sports. Baseball in the courtroom, NFL at the negotiating table. Well, at least they're playing soccer on the field. The U.S. women's team is in the World Cup final on Sunday. Howard Bryant of ESPN.com and ESPN The Magazine joins us. Morning, Howard.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Terrific.
Well, you didn't have to cover the Roger Clemens trial, which I know you had clear time to do.
I was on my way down there and got a call saying, stand down. Mistrial.
Well, so, a mistrial. Huge error by the prosecution.
Gigantic.
Judge called it, with incredulity, a mistake a first-year law student would make when they put some inadmissible evidence into a video. Is the case over? Is this story over for Roger Clemens?
Well, I think you're going to have to leave that to the legal mind sharper than me. I think the question is simply going to be whether or not a judge determines that Roger Clemens has been permanently prejudiced and cannot receive a fair trial. If Reggie Walton decides that on August 6th, then it's over. There won't be another trial. If he determines that there will be a chance for a new jury to come in and give Roger Clemens a fair trial, then we'll do this all over again at taxpayer expense, and you will pay the bill.
Personally, I understand.
You personally, Scott, will pay the bill for this.
I want to ask you about the British Open. I don't think anybody's alleged that Tom Watson's wonderful shot yesterday has anything to do with performance-enhancing drugs. At the age of 61, he hit a hole-in-one.
Giving hope to everybody out there, and it's a wonderful thing. And that's one of the reasons why you watch sports, why you care about it so much, is because, especially with a game like golf, there are thousands upon thousands of people out there saying, you know, if Tom Watson can do it at that stage, then I can go to my local club and I can do it as well. It's great stuff, and I think that there's always at some tournament, one of the majors, one of the legends comes out and gives you a little bit of magic, and this was an example of that. Especially with a tournament that's as wide open as this, you've got Darren Clarke, second place, trying to win his first major from Northern Ireland. You've got Lucas Glover in first place, and he won the Open and not the U. He won the U.S. Open in 2009, and you've got really really awful English weather right now as well. So it's going to be a great tournament. Obviously, the next 2 days are going to determine the whole thing.
Are they putting drivers in the baby bassinets in Northern Ireland now? I mean, this proliferation of great Irish golfers is amazing.
Well, it's like the Spanish with tennis. Yeah. There are certain generations where countries just begin to dominate, or the Kenyans when it comes to marathoning. And this is this generation where you've just produced a great run of golfers.
Are they getting close to a deal to end the National Football League lockout?
Well, I think it depends on how much power the owners are willing to give up. I think they came very close to a deal over the last couple of days simply because the owners have decided that, gee, you know, players should have the right to become free agents. After this lockout, the owners wanted a major concession, which was to have the players give up a right of first refusal when they're free agents. Well, that kind of defeats the purpose of being a free agent. And in return, the players said, no, we're not going to do that. And the owners conceded to giving the players 4 years of unrestricted free agency, which is what they're supposed to have. I think this is the big thing in football, control over players and control over salaries. It's the only sport where you have a hard cap, where you control player salaries, and you don't have completely unrestricted, unlimited free agency when a player's contract is up. This is the line in the sand on top of trying to split up $9 billion of revenue.
Well, they don't have that problem in the U.S. Women's Soccer League. The U.S. women's team is going to face Japan in the World Cup final tomorrow in Frankfurt. You like their chances?
I do. However, I think that, once again, the shadow of the 99 team and the shadow of Mia Hamm and the great run that the women's team has had over the last 15-plus years is – it can give us a false sense of security that this is going to be a walkover. Japan is a very, very good team. Mm-hmm. And if the Japanese were American, shall we say, if we were talking about an American sport, we would be talking about them being the sentimental favorites because of the tsunami, because of the earthquake, because of all of the awful things that country has had to go through. And they are playing with an unbelievable amount of emotion. They're playing with heavy hearts. They're playing with passion. And they're playing as underdogs, in a sense, after beating Sweden and beating Germany. It's a wonderful story. Now, they've never beaten the Americans. They're 0-22-3 all time. The Americans beat them twice as well. And so it's going to be a great battle. But once you get into a championship, all that history kind of goes out the window, and you have to go out and play for 90-plus minutes.
Howard, we got an actual piece now. Howard Bryant of ESPN, thanks so much.
Have fun, Scott.
The astronauts aboard the space shuttle Atlantis received a special call today.
Hello, Mr. President. You're talking to the Increment 28 crew and the crew of the space shuttle Atlantis. Well, that's funny, see, because I was just dialing out for pizza.
Houston, we have an order. President Obama phoned the Atlantis crew along with the crew of the International Space Station.
And all joking aside, Mr. Obama thanked the astronauts for their hard work. He said their mission marks a new era of pushing the limits of space exploration, ultimately working toward a trip to Mars.
And back to the jokes, The president offered his sympathies when one of the astronauts said they'd all become a big family in a short amount of time.
You need to be like a family because I'm assuming you have to share pretty cramped quarters in a bathroom. So, my wife and my daughters are always crowding me out.
But Shuttle Commander Chris Ferguson assured the president that, as far as the rest of the universe is concerned, the accommodations really aren't so bad.
We actually have three bathrooms on board, and we have a gym. We have several bedrooms. It's probably one of the more spacious homes that there is outside of planet Earth.
And what a view.
Now from a man of numbers to a beloved boy wizard, the eighth and final Harry Potter movie hit theaters this week. Each of these extravagantly successful films brought certain excitement to fans, but for those unacquainted with Hogwarts and Horcruxes, NPR's Sammy Yenigan has a cheat sheet.
All right, you muggles, let's take this thing from the top.
Dear Mr. Potter, we are pleased to inform you that you have been accepted at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
You're a wizard, Harry.
And a damn fine wizard. Harry needed to learn magic because he's got the meanest son of a gun ever after him, Lord Voldemort.
I must be the one to kill Harry Potter.
See, Voldemort killed Harry's parents, and he tried to kill Harry when he was a baby. Now, Voldemort's building an army, and he's trying to kill Harry again.
If Voldemort's raising an army, then I want to fight.
Attaboy, Harry.
But you can't fight this war on your own.
Don't be silly. Harry's best buds Ron and Hermione have his back.
You may be the chosen one, mate. This is a whole lot bigger than that.
It's dangerous, Harry.
And if that ain't enough, the most legendary of all wizards, Professor Dumbledore, is also looking out for Harry.
Take my arm.
So Dumbledore put together a gang to fight the Dark Lord, including Professor Snape, the potions teacher at Hogwarts.
Dumbledore is a great wizard. Only a fool would question it.
Amen. That's about the only thing that Harry Potter and Professor Snape have ever agreed on.
Do you take pride in being an insufferable know-it-all?
Hey, man, I'm just stating the facts.
Avada Kedavra.
Whoa now, plot twist. At the end of movie 6, Snape killed Dumbledore, and everyone is super bummed. Stay with me now. Here's where it gets tricky. There are these things called Horcruxes.
What are they exactly?
Voldemort split his soul up into 8 pieces and hid them in 8 Horcruxes.
This is very dark stuff, very dark indeed.
That's what I'm saying, and so now Harry and his friends need to find these Horcruxes and destroy them. Okay, so that's close to 20 hours of movie right there, and here's where we stand going into the finale. Harry's having a hard time finding Horcruxes.
Did you think we were going to be staying in a 5-star hotel, finding a Horcrux every other day?
Voldemort needs to find Harry.
I'm going to kill you, Harry Potter.
Ron and Hermione gotta get a room.
Ronald Weasley, you show up here after weeks, and you say, hey?
And I need to find a new epic series with castles and magic and wizards. Wonder when Game of Thrones is back on. Sammy Yenigan, NPR News.
More than 22,000 people were disappointed and probably angry yesterday. There were people who thought they'd won spots to enter the United States in last May's U.S. State Department lottery. Then the U.S. government announced that a computer glitch made the lottery invalid. Many who'd been told they had won, told their children, quit their jobs, got married, or sold their homes to get ready to make new lives here. 36 people filed suit to get the State Department to uphold the results. This week, District Judge Amy Berman Jackson offered sympathy for the pain and loss of those who were misinformed, but she said the government was right to invalidate the drawing because the 22,000 informed that they'd won were not a good random sample, which was the design of the lottery. There are 19 million more stories, many of which may be equally or even more compelling, the judge wrote. Attorneys for the plaintiff said The American government has lost credibility, promising 22,000 individuals the right to proceed with the immigration process, and then snatching away that hope and promise. And you're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Join us now on a trip back to the early 13th century in the land we now call Italy to hear numerous tales of a man called Leonardo, enshrined in history as Fibonacci and his Liber Abaci. Huh? Leonardo da Vinci told a fib about Liberace? Okay, take two. The year 1202, a young mathematician named Leonardo da Pisa, no relation to da Vinci, published a book titled Liber Abaci. That's Latin for Book of Calculation, which introduced practical uses for the Hindu-Arabic numerals 0 through 9 to Western Europe for the very first time. The book revolutionized commerce, banking, science, and technology, and established the basis of modern arithmetic, algebra, and other disciplines. And we do mean disciplines. Our math guy Keith Devlin has a new book out about that book and its author. It's called The Man of Numbers, Fibonacci's Arithmetic Revolution. Keith joins us from studios at Stanford University, where he teaches. Keith, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be here again.
This book sold even more copies than the Monk's Book of Diet and Exercise, didn't it?
Actually, you know, what happened, this is really kind of interesting. One of the things I like about Leonardo, especially living here in the middle of Silicon Valley, is he knew how to market something. Having written this really big, incredible book, he realized that that book was probably too difficult for most of the people he was trying to reach, which are the traders and the commercial people in Pisa, which at the time was the center of the Western commercial world. He ended up writing a smaller, easier-to-read version of that book. And in many ways, it was a combination of the big scholastic book and the smaller, easier-to-read version that really caused this, what was in fact the world's first revolution in personal computing.
Do you compare him to some major figures today?
This is Steve Jobs, Bill Gates. It's the computer revolution that we lived through in the 1980s, and the parallels are actually uncanny.
Well, take them up for us. Because as I understand it, you know, 0 to 9 numerals had been around in Hindu and Arabic cultures for centuries.
The numerals were around and sort of people knew that you could represent numbers with them. But that wasn't how people did business. What they did was they recorded everything in good old Roman numerals. Mm-hmm. And if they wanted calculations, they went down the street to someone who was adept at using a physical abacus. It was actually a board on which you moved, with lines ruled on it, on which you moved pebbles around. But it was a very crude and inefficient way of doing business. What Leonardo does, and when he sees this method and writes this book, Liber Abaci, which is really the first practical arithmetic textbook in the Western world, within a few decades of Liber Abaci appearing, you've got what may have been 1,000 or more different people writing practical arithmetic textbooks. What was happening, the ordinary person who wanted to set up a business and didn't have a lot of money to pay people to do the accounting for them, could do it for themselves. If you look at the beginnings of accounting, double entry bookkeeping, insurance, banking, all of that commercial stuff, it all came out of Pisa in the 13th century. And the key for that to happen was that people could do arithmetic efficiently for the first time in history.
So why is Leonardo da Pisa referred to as Fibonacci?
He was given that name by a historian. The name is actually comes from the Latin phrase filius Bonacci. In the beginning of Leonardo's book, he says this is the book of calculation written by the son of Bonacci, filius Bonacci. He uses that phrase in the first opening sentence. And so this historian in the 19th century takes that phrase filius Bonacci, simplifies it to Bonacci, and for reasons best known to himself, gives Leonardo that nickname.
If Liber Abaci hadn't been written, would trading anything more than a couple of sacks of grain be possible?
It would have happened, sure. I mean, one of the things about almost all of mathematics is that it'll eventually surface and get used. It's a matter of who does it and when. And this is another of those similarities between Leonardo and Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and the people in the 1980s. And what Jobs did was simply take something that other people had developed and present it in a very easy-to-use way and essentially turned computing into a consumer product. That's what Leonardo did.
Keith Devlin, our math guy, his new book, The Man of Numbers, Fibonacci's Arithmetic Revolution hit the bookstores this week, and you can read an excerpt on our website at npr.org. Thanks so much, Keith.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott, as usual.